Welcome back to Shattering Us. We have Glenn on the line. Good afternoon, Glenn.
Good morning, Yana. Can you hear me?
I can. Go ahead.
Oh, very good, very good. We always seem to be running into all these barbarities associated with Islam. And I always hear when this comes up, and it's definitely irrefutable that these things are going with Islam. But I just hear the atheists screaming, as I have many times. But what about 1 Samuel 15? You know, in which Saul fails to utterly slaughter the Amalekites. You know, men, women, children, and animals. Is this not a, you know, they'll say, is this not also barbaric? So I figured I'd
It is a tough comparison, and the reason it's a tough comparison is that you really have to take the time to read the story that Yah was presenting in context and understand what he is asking and why. Now, first of all, the primary difference between the two, before we get into the context of the story that Yahweh is revealing here, is that there are there's a period of time for about 60 years in a very finite place where there are about a handful of towns that Yahweh once exterminated in the Promised Land. And the purpose of that is because he wants to settle his family in his home. And we'll get to his theme here in a moment, why he's asking for this. But the difference with Islam is that in Islam, the command to kill and to eliminate anyone who doesn't capitulate to the religion of Islam is for the whole world and for all time. There are no limitations. It doesn't say, you know, in this city that existed 3,000 years ago, or this town that existed 3,000 years ago, in this really tiny place at this specific time, there is nothing like that in the Quranic proclamations. It's always the entire world for all time. And it's always to impose the Islamic religion on the entire world for all time. Now, in Yahweh's case, he was taking his children into a really tiny place that, you know, he created the universe, and it's his planet. And this really tiny slice of this planet represents about less than 0.1% of the landmass on Earth. And he says, in this one place, this is going to be the home for my children. And he wanted his home rid of the most deadly pestilence the world has ever known, religion. And the only way that you can rid a place of religion is to eliminate the host of religion. The host of religion is always human beings. And so it's very much like a father going into being led to, you know, let's just put ourselves in a different time, and you've taken your family across the country. There's a particularly tract of land that has been promised to you after 40 years of walking across the country with your family. You finally come to the homestead that's been promised to you, and you find that homestead is infested with venomous snakes and rats that have the plague. Are you going to say, hey, come on, let's say everybody live together. We're just going to be one happy family. Let's move in. Or you find the homestead those next door have the plague, and there's no cure for it. They have smallpox, and there's no known cure. What do you do? You say, come on, family. Let's move right on in. Let's share this home with those who have smallpox and with rats that have the plague. Would you be a loving father under those circumstances? And that's what
someone will undoubtedly challenge that as this, and the standard argument is that before you can perpetrate a war, you have to first dehumanize the potential enemy. And they'll say, making them analogous to a plague or plague-infested people or zombies, mm-hmm. the current model of zombies.
Mm-hmm. God's not trying to dehumanize them. He's just saying
that's what your analogy does.
I can see that. The analogy explains the father's interest in protecting his children. So what I explained is God's perspective on this. But since I shared God's perspective on it. And his perspective is the one that matters to me. I can understand that his perspective of trying to rid his home of disease isn't one that would appeal to an atheist. So I'll agree with that. But if there really is a God and this was really God's instructions and God actually proves himself as part of these instructions, doesn't he have the right?
Well, yeah. Argument would be that God has ordained that all humans should eventually die, and that they're his creatures, and he can decide who dies when anyway. But, I mean, yeah, and his judgments are just.
The difference here is there is no other text in which the inspiration from for that text absolutely proves beyond any doubt that he exists and that he's God. And it changes things entirely when you view it from the perspective of this particular text of the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms proves conclusively that God exists, that he authored these books, and therefore these are his instructions. So when a religious individual says we should go kill them and we have the right to kill them, but that religious individual isn't speaking for God and God did not prove that he made that statement, then you're dealing with a man-made edict versus if there really is a God and he proved that he is God and he says, I want you to do this for this reason, then you can be the atheist all day long and say, I don't like this God. I don't like his reasons. But you can't deny the fact that he has the authority.
Right, right. Well, and the same atheists, of course, will justify their wars on the basis of a lesser authority of something like, political principle or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
They don't always act, completely defensively. I mean, certainly communists. I always point out to the atheists that more people died at the hands of atheist communists in the 20th century than ever died, at the hands of the religious.
Of course, because Hitler was an atheist, and the fact is that there really is no distinction between the National Socialist Party and Germany and the Communist Party and Russia. They were both dictators, both of which managed their countries politically and economically the same way. And so there really was no difference between the two, other than there were individuals that still got to own the businesses, even though Hitler completely controlled them. And so between Hitler and Mao Zedong and Stalin, you're correct that far more people were killed in the name of atheists and communism than were ever killed in the name of religion.
Right. Actually, you have this question of whether some of these people were crypto-religious, crypto-occultists or something. Like, for example, why is Lenin buried in a step period in the middle of a red square, which is all highly symbolic?
Seriously.
It was an atheist. Hitler spent a lot of resources chasing down occult stuff.
The fact of the matter is, I would tell you that man is a religious creature, and that we have a tendency to manufacture gods, and our favorite gods are gods that are manufactured in our own image. For example, Allah was manufactured in Muhammad's image. Most of the Greek gods and the Roman gods were manufactured in the emperor's images. So it's typical for man to create a religious construct. In the Mein Kampf, the god of Mein Kampf is modeled after Hitler. So you're right. They're really not atheistic. They are, but in the time that I spent in the Soviet Union, while it was still the Soviet Union, one of the things that became so obvious is that they turned Marx and Lenin and then even Stalin into gods. They're chiseled likenesses in statues and billboards. They actually gave these men deified features, and they published their sayings and their writings as if they were scripture. They turned men into objects of worship, into gods.
Well, the same as the Muslim world, huge depictions on the sides of buildings and stuff.
Yes. So if you look at, you're right, if you look at the atheist and the atheist complaining that, well, God doesn't have the right to cleanse his home of that kind of pestilence, and yet look what atheists and communists have done to purge their countries of those that didn't capitulate.
Boy, if they didn't like them going after the Amalekites, hang around and wait to see the Magog battle in Armageddon. You're really going to hate that.
Yes. Yeah, in that particular case, God's going to eliminate all of them. Every individual who comes into Israel as a Muslim to ravage the country, every single one of them is going to die.
Right.
Now, they're not going to die a painful death. God's not into torment. He's not going to create a spectacle that causes the world to cower in fear. No one is going to be tortured. There'll be no crucifixions. They're going to be alive 1 minute and gone the next. It'll be painless, but they will be destroyed. And they're going to be destroyed because if God does not intervene and destroy them, they will destroy Israel. They will wipe out every last Israelite, which would mean that God could not fulfill his promise to reconcile his relationship with them. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're having a discussion with Glenn. Glenn, I'm going to ask you a question. If you were divine, if you were capable of knowing anything that you wanted to know, and you could determine with absolute certainty the 1,000 individuals that were going to be the most responsible for the rise of communism in China, knowing that if they were not stopped, that between 30 and more and 40 million people would die, would you put those 1,000 people, those 1,000 initial communists in China to death to save the lives of 30 to 40 million?
Well, it would give it some serious thought. I think about that stuff all the time. I often think back to when Ed Koch was mayor of New York and you had the New York death penalty controversy, you know. And people would argue and say, but the death penalty doesn't work. And Ed Koch says, yeah, it does. You just have to do it enough. Not doing it enough. You have to apply it across the board. And then people think twice about killing people, And so it's a similar thing.
Let me give one a little more personal to you in terms of contemporary issue. There are the 1,000 Muslims that were most responsible in Boko Haram for either kidnapping and raping and murdering those 300 girls or making it possible for that team to go off and do that. If you were given the opportunity and you knew exactly who they were, there was absolutely no doubt who they were and what they were going to do, would you kill 500 of them to save those 300 innocent girls?
Me personally, yeah. And then, but then I've often, you know, if you take the story of Ananias and Sapphira in the Book of Acts, literally, mm-hmm. I don't know if you accept that story or not, but here you have God personally terminating husband and wife for reneging on a land pledge. You know, they, in other words, because ostensibly the offenses has to do with the fact that they lied to God's spirit. You know, so supposedly they died for this offense. It's like, wow, God's taking people out for reneging on a pledge. So that doesn't bode well for people who do telephone calls and then don't send in the check. But then it's like, wow, if we'll whack somebody for that, why doesn't he go after the people with these really heinous crimes? It's like, yeah, I wish God were systematically, I can provide him a list.
There's a reason for that. Yeah, there's, okay. First of all, what I want to do is before we talk about why there are some of those examples in the Torah, Prophets, and Psalms, is that there is a direct tie-in between being omniscient and knowing, being, living outside of the constraints of time, and knowing the direct consequence of a group of people because of the religions that they have embraced and the consequence of those religions. You know, for example, Islam has killed hundreds of millions of people. It continues to torment people every day, terrorizing them, raping them, kidnapping them, killing them. And so the willingness to allow a religion like that to fester and grow has a tremendous consequence on innocent people. And that's what God was trying to avoid in Yisrael. And it would have been extraordinarily compassionate to take the life of the few to spare the torment to the many. And an example of where it was not done and what the consequence would be is Mecca in the 7th century. This is the consequence of it. Now, a lot of people do wonder. I mean, there's even a case of a guy that was picking up kindling on the Shabbat, and Moshe saying, "Hey, what should we do?" And God says, "Kill him." And a person welched on a business deal. And God says, yeah, what should you do? Kill them. Why do those examples exist? And is it different if it's actually God saying it or a person deciding it? And it's a very unique situation. And rather than God going after the Paul, who created a religion that has killed many, the example he gives of someone that, yeah, you might as well go ahead and take their life, is the person who disregarded the Shabbat, the purpose of the Shabbat, or somebody who deliberately flaunted it, and or somebody who welched on an agreement, who lied in a business transaction. And when we return to Shattering Myths, we'll consider why God has that view. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're talking about why God made an example of several individuals in terms of they did things that were inconsistent with his teaching, and he says, all right, take their lives. It is a very unique situation. I think one of the things you have to do to understand God's perspective is to recognize that he proves his existence in this testimony. So this is actually the creator of the universe, a God who absolutely proves that he is the creator, that he was there at creation, that he conceived life. He's the author of DNA. He's the author of the Torah. And he demonstrates this conclusively. And he then will told Moshe, yep, there's a guy out there that's picking up sticks. He's purposefully, deliberately flaunting the Shabbat, which is a day to set apart, keep it special, and to revel in our relationship with God. And he says, you know, what should we do with this guy? And he says, just kill him. He says, well, that's horrible. No, wait a minute. God's not taking anything away from this person. He isn't. God is responsible for that individual's life. He gave him life. All of us. You know, we are all given a mortal existence. It's kind of like my view of the person who says you're taking my money away from me. Why are you taking my money away from me when if they're on welfare, for example, and you've given this person $1,000 a month for every month for 10 years, and then you said, you know, I just don't want to do it anymore. You're not taking anything away from them. You gave them, you know, $12,000 a year for 10 years, so you gave them $120,000 they would not have otherwise had, and you're just going to stop it. Now, God is conceived the mortal life that that person was enjoying up to that point. I'm not even sure enjoying is the right term, but gave them the mortal life, and he said, you know, that's it. I want that mortal life ended right there. He didn't take away everything that they had in the past, which he gave them. Without him, they would not have had. But the purpose is to demonstrate that if you want to continue to live, you need to pay attention to what God is saying. If you want to continue to live, then pay attention to his guidance. He's very seldom will truncate a life, but when he does, it's just like the welfare check. If you pay it for every month for 10 years, $1,000 a month, and then the first month of the 11th year decide not to pay it anymore, you haven't taken anything away. But that's only true if you're the person that conceived the life in the first place.
Right.
And the purpose there is to underscore the importance of, I gave you a mortal existence, but if you're going to disregard the guidance that I have provided to transition from the mortal existence to an eternal existence, then you're going to die. So let's make this point vivid, because if I make the point vivid in this one individual, maybe that'll awaken 1,000 individuals. And by the 1,000 may benefit.
Right.
And what he's saying is that one individual, he wasn't God knew he was never going to get it. So that person was never going to become immortal. So God didn't take immortality from him.
Right. Well, the first retort to the atheist is, you know, as Job says, God, Yahweh giveth and Yahweh taketh away, blessed be the name of Yahweh, right? So it's his value. Then I would suggest that another, and this all falls under the theological heading of what's called theodicy, which you're probably familiar with. Theodicy is the study of evil, you know, the question of the effects of sin and evil. And another possible reason is that from his time transcendent perspective, God also understands the implications of everything he does.
Correct.
So, in other words, well, why does God allow this to happen? Well, there could be implications down the road in the time-space continuum. It's kind of like these movies where you have, like, butterfly effect, where you change one thing and the whole world goes cattywampus.
Right.
God knows the implications of everything he does and doesn't do.
Right. And God cannot micromanage. He can't protect everyone from harm. If he protected everyone from harm, then the whole human experience would be nothing but a charade. It would be just a cruel hoax. Because
God would be completely and eternally codependent to our sin.
Correct. That is correct.
Yeah.
So he can't do that. There's lots of things you can say that God can't do. And one of the things is that he can't micromanage so as to protect everybody from harm. So bad things happen. Not because that's what he wishes, but because that's what people bring on themselves. And God cannot stand in the way of all those bad things happening. Otherwise, there'd be no purpose for life. There'd be no purpose for coming to know him. So he does not do those sorts of things. But again, the key aspect of all of this is taking the time to understand the context of the revelation. And if you are doing your job in the context of the revelation and you come across, all right, here I've got a creation account that is wholly consistent with science, and that now that I have this great gift of knowing how time was stretched at creation to 10 to the 12th power, and I can divide the 14 billion years since the Big Bang by 10 to the 12th power, and I get 6 days. You know, you ought to be paying attention at that point. And you really ought to be paying attention. And then when you have all of these prophecies, all of which have been fulfilled, and I'm going through the prophecies in Daniel now about just the nuances of Babylon and the nuances associated with Persia and with Greece and with Rome, and how he had every aspect of that right before these events took place. Somewhere along the lines, you've got to say, yeah, he really is God. He really is God. And it behooves us to understand why he's saying these things. It's an entirely different perspective. And I understand the atheist is going to say, you know, but all religions claim that their deity is God. But then you're not listening, dear atheist. This is not a book that claims that Yahweh is God. This is a book that proves that he is God. You know, the proof that he is God is every bit as dramatic, if not more dramatic, than the proof for the law of thermodynamics. He proves it conclusively. And we can observe that proof when we wish to. So that's always been my answer to that is, all right, since he proves that he is God, if you want to understand why these things are being said, view him in the role of father and Israelites in the role of children and Israel in the role of his home, and now consider what you would do in those circumstances. What would a loving, moral father do in those circumstances? And yeah, I agree with you that part of the continuum is hugely influenced. For example, if God had rid the world of Hadrian, who was such a savage, think of how different the world would be now. What if God had precluded Satan from revealing himself to Paul on the road to Damascus? Think of how radically different the world would be, and how all of the things that God has told us about, they wouldn't materialize. And the world would be just so stunningly different than it is right now. So, you have to be careful.
And if junk food hadn't been invented, think how much leaner I could be.
I had a friend sent me an article the other day. It was actually a video article, well produced as a documentary, but it's challenging for me because I typically prefer my information in written form rather than verbal form. But it was an analysis, and this is something you probably know a lot more about than I do, of the radical increase in the prescription of mind-altering drugs, of the psychiatric drugs that are designed to deal with depression or with delusional behavior. And what they have done to the individuals, first of all, the massive number of people that are taking them, and what they have done to those people's ability to make good decisions and moral decisions, and the propensity of those who take these drugs to inflict harm to others. What's your impression of this? Is it as big a problem as I'm hearing that it's the prescription of those drugs is not only massive business, but it's massively influencing our society?
Oh, I think so. And routinely, for a lot, when I first took my first job in psychiatric facility, The standard, the historical line had always been the vast number of people, the largest majority of people hospitalized were for schizophrenia. I very much doubt that's the case. Now, schizophrenia is relatively treatable these days. You know, good. Right. It's all this stuff that's being administered for what are essentially anxiety disorders, you know, the neuroses.
Yes.
And all of this selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, you know, the SSRIs. Right. And I didn't start reading my first articles about, you know, neurotransmitters until the late 70s. But now this is all about toying with these, you know, these neurotransmitters. And what I'm afraid that they're going to say is like everybody's, you know, crazy. I mean, there's so many people taking drugs that the water, you know, the sewage treatment plants can't get the drugs out of the water. It goes back into, you know, into the water sources, into the water with these drugs still in it. And yeah, everybody's going to be, you know, dealing with all these toxins. They want to recirculate. Go from sewage plant back to tap water with some of this stuff. People are going to be getting drugs from all this.
Yeah. You're pretty good at research, and this is something that's right up your alley. Would you mind sometime over the next week or so taking a look as to how pervasive these drugs are in the West? I mean, you just do the United States. What percentage of the population is taking medication for anything from anxiety to depression, for psychological issues, and what effect those drugs may be having on those individuals in terms of their ability to reason, to execute moral judgment, and how prone they may be to harming others. Welcome back to Generating This. We have both Larry and Glenn on the line, and their discussion is on anti-anxiety and anti-depression drugs. And one of the challenges, fellows, in trying to understand the prevalence of these things is many of the studies that are done on them are done, you know, by those that have an agenda, and you don't really get the whole truth. I just, the first thing I went to is a website where I typed in percentage of the population taking antidepressant, anxiety drugs. And the first site that came to publish by a credible source talks about all of the studies that have been done on the side effect of anti-anxiety drugs. And here's just some of the list of the studies. 8 studies on how anti-anxiety drugs impair cognitive function. Cognitive function means you can't think correctly. They cause amnesia. You can't remember. They cause hallucinations. They cause delusional thinking. They cause abnormal behavior. They cause suicide risk. They cause violence against others in society. They cause agitation. That's not good things, are they?
Well, no, the hallucinations and delusions sound more like the stuff of schizophrenia. Well, you started out with a mood disorder and ended up with a psychosis.
Yeah.
I posted a study here last week dealing with, you know, all the high suicide rates of the military.
Right. Yes.
You know, the amazing thing about it, and this is the thing that amazed me the most, 82% of these people committing suicides in the military have never seen combat. 57% have never even been deployed. But
wow.
Nearly all of them are on psychotropic drugs.
Wow.
That's amazing.
Wow. You know, when I first encountered this, guys, I was trying to find a common denominator in all of the mass shootings, because everybody said the common denominator was the gun, but you know, the thing that I found was the common denominator was the drugs. It wasn't ubiquitous. It wasn't 100%, but it was somewhere in the range of 90 to 95% of the mass shootings, mass killings, mass murders was somebody who had either recently been prescribed a mind-altering drug, one of these antidepressant, anti-anxiety drugs, mood elevators, or somebody who had just gone off of them, or someone who had just switched brands. So either recently going on, recently going off, or switching brands, that it was like 95%.
I think it found a scientifically valid statistical
correlation.
Correlation. Yes, thank you. Yeah. Wow. 95%. Yeah. And again, when I was reading about all the suicides, of which there are so many in the military now that
right.
have become, you know, a real problem.
Yeah. Yeah. 22 per day that are published, but they're only publishing the data from 40% of the states who are only reporting 70% of the suicides of veterans in those states. So if you correlate the 22 per day that are being published in 40% of the states, 40% of the population by state, and these only reporting 30% of the suicides even within those states, the actual number is 80 per day. And so 80 per day is a real
2% have never even been in combat. I thought these people were all broken up about, you know, going over and shooting some guy on a bicycle. But that
let me throw one thought at you though, Larry. There is something that I think is worse than combat, and that's the indoctrination that you're put through in the military. You know, if you're going to be in the military, you are going to be indoctrinated in their world.
That's what boot camp is. That's right.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And so there could be a significant just residual effect from the military indoctrination.
As an example, when I was in, there was nowhere near that suicide rate. No, I mean, nothing even close to it. What they're seeing here is a correlation between the suicide rate and the psychotropic drugs.
Yes.
I mean, that's what's going on.
The drugs have to be prescribed for a reason. So while I agree with you that the correlation is scientifically valid and extraordinarily revealing, there's still an element of this that I would love to have pinned down as to why high a number of veterans are being prescribed these drugs. What was the trigger? Well, gentlemen, we'll continue this conversation. We're going to turn to Paul's testimony and Yahweh's actual testimony against Paul when we return to the next hour. But this is a discussion that I'd love to have with you guys next week, because it is extraordinarily important.